Also, Detroit Brooks plays the Barker Legacy live with his band, the Syncopated Percolators, on American Roots from PRX.
Sundays from 1 to 3 a.m. or anytime on the KKFI 2-Week Archive.
You are tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect those of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Mid-Coast Radio Project, its board, staff, and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Before we get started today, Kansas City has lost a couple of icons in the African-American community. Rodney McFadden, part of the Brothers McFadden. And then this morning it was announced that Ida Macbeth, the legendary jazz singer, has passed away. So we are fastly losing our history. So today there are not too many shows that somebody gets to do that they're really in the bucket list. And today's guest is, once I learned about the Tulsa Massacre, I made it a mission to get the director of that museum on the show because it's the worst race riot ever that was held in America that is still not known throughout America. And this morning we have Mr. Raymond Doswell, who is director of the Greenwood Rising Museum, and he is our guest today. Good morning, Raymond. Are you with us, sir?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you. Raymond, can you tell listeners a little about yourself? Are you originally from the Kansas City metropolitan area?
Well, I'm originally from the St. Louis area, but I've spent close to 30 years in Kansas City being vice president and curator at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And I want to say I certainly want to pass my thoughts along to the McFadden and Macbeth family. I certainly had enjoyed their performances when I lived there, and it is truly a sad day.
Raymond, as you said, you worked at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, but now you are director of the Greenwood Rising Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What made you decide to want to work at the Greenwood Rising Museum and take that position as director?
Well, they did a national search, and initially I was contacted by them initially they were looking just for candidates for the job. I hadn't thought of myself as a candidate, only because I wasn't deeply familiar with the whole history of Greenwood and Tulsa Race Massacre, which I knew about, but wasn't my primary expertise, especially having been working in baseball for so many years. But I did give them some names, but their search firm called back and said, no, we want to talk to you. We think your experience would be ideal for what we're trying to do. So as I talked to them, I was getting, thinking about my own experience as a museum leader and expressed that and the ideas that I would have, and it aligned with what their needs were. And so we started to very seriously pursue it. And I've been looking for opportunities to lead. That opportunity was presented and I took it. And here I am. I've been here just over a month and learning quite a bit about this very intense but important history.
Raymond, this is by far the worst race riot and race massacre that was ever conducted on American soil, And this happened in 1921. And growing up, I grew up and I never heard about it during Black History. I never knew anything about it. And I even had the director of the Tulsa, she did the play on Greenwood here. How is it something that has happened so long ago, but it seems like there's no information out there? And unless you know what you're looking for, you can't find it.
Well, there is plenty of information out there, but you do have to look for it. But at the same time, I think it's fair to say that, especially in the last few years, with our reckoning and awakening on race, one has to go back through the history and understand that none of the issues that we were seeing in the aftermath of George Floyd or any of the other senseless killings and protests and things, none of this is new. And it goes back many years. And the fact of the time of being in the throes of the pandemic showed us specifically that over 100 years ago to this time, that there were several different incidents, including Tulsa, that marred the country. And a lot of things stemmed out of, at least back then, stemmed out of, in part, reactions to the end of World War One and what was going on nationally. African Americans are migrating from the South to the Midwest and the North, putting pressure on many different cities for population, for jobs, competition for jobs, competition for resources. Politicians are pitting ethnic groups against each other to just have control of the situation. And that is essentially, in many respects, what is happening in many of the different so-called riots and things that were happening back then, going back to, and it goes further back, but I'm learning about Atlanta in 1906 and then Houston in 1917, East St. Louis in 1917, Tulsa in 1921, even Rosewood in 1923, all have to do with the anti-Black sentiment that was happening across the country and all the things I just mentioned. So the history is there. It's always been there. But I will say, and as you probably learned from talking to the playwright of the play about Tulsa, is that her generation and the generation before of African Americans were shunned from talking about it, primarily because the folks who lived through it have the post-traumatic stress of having dealing with it and wanting to bury it. The white perpetrators wanted to bury it. And for many years here in Oklahoma, it was mentioned but never fully taught in schools anywhere. But that all changed. And it has changed over the years. And the community is beginning to come out and talk about it. But to this day, visitors to the museum, especially those who live in Oklahoma, white and Black, they come in. They said they may have heard about it, but it's something that their parents never talked about and that it wasn't really taught to them in any deep detail in schools. But that is changing now.
And to piggyback on something that you mentioned, in doing research for the study, we talked about the Red Summer, where there were no less than, I want to say it's 30, there were at least 35 different racial incidents that happened across the United States. And this was in 1919, as you said, Tulsa. People may not know, Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, was a site of a rising. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said St. Louis, Omaha, mm-hmm. Nebraska, all of these places. And some of it came from, there were new Black veterans who had fought in World War One who believed that they had received their rights, that they were free and equal citizens, only to find out that they weren't. And that began to, you know, that began to incense some of the non-minorities. And it just, it went across the nation. And it's something that in some places we're still dealing with today, just it's racism, but maybe just in another little bit of a shade. But how long has the museum been in existence there in the Tulsa area?
The museum is very new. It was completed in 2021, which was the 100th anniversary of the race massacre here in Tulsa. And community groups that wanted to, as part of the commemoration, wanted to have this new edifice in the city. And it sits at the intersection of Greenwood Avenue and Archer Street, which is the historic gateway to the North Tulsa area, but also to what is affectionately known as Black Wall Street, which was the business district for the Greenwood neighborhood. So it's very new, and there's a lot of things, even as a new director, that small things that I want to change, but for the most part, it is a great edifice, and it's a great stimulating learning environment. It was created as an immersive exhibit, so there's a lot of tech and technology, but it's not touch screens and things like that. It's all meant to kind of drive your emotions and drive information and give you a compelling narrative about what happened and hopefully spark you to want to not only learn more about it, but also learn more about race reconciliation as well. And I should point out, even though the race massacre is a huge component of the exhibit, it is not the only thing that's talked about. We talk about the creation of the Greenwood District, the building of Black Wall Street, and then, of course, the aftermath of what happened in 1921, and then the fact that this community is so extremely resilient, how they were able to rebuild in the midst of what will become the Civil Rights Movement, and still gets many setbacks after that, but it's there, and it's coming back to life in many respects with the businesses and things like that. This was never necessarily a Black utopia, but it had a great concentration of Black wealth, people are wanting to at least bring it back as an important business district.
And as you talk about the 100-year anniversary, President Joe Biden visited the area on June 1st, 2021. He was the first sitting president to do so, and during the visit, he made a speech in which he stated, "Some injustices are so heinous, so horrific, so grievous, they cannot be buried no matter how hard people try." Mm-hmm. He toured the Greenwood Cultural Center area and met with survivors Viola Fletcher, Hughes Van Ellis, and Leslie Bingham Randall. And it's like the newspaper, if you go and read the story, they went through and they basically sanitized everything to kind of, even though the media played a huge part in this, you know, there was a commission done in 1995 and they offered a bounty for the Tulsa Tribune front page from that time because it told why a lot of things that led up to the event, but also what was the media's role. It showed the media's role in black and white, as they put it. But unfortunately, down through history, all that had been changed within a week of the event, and people wanted to act like it never happened. So, Raymond, we briefly touched on it, but what is the mission of the Greenwood Rising Museum?
Well, for Greenwood Rising, the goal was to tell the story of Greenwood in its entirety, including our understanding of the race massacre. Honor the victims and descendants of that event, but again, tell the entire story of Greenwood. So its rise, its destruction, its rebirth as well. And so we do our best to do that. The museum initially opened for free. We do charge admission now, but we're getting visitors from all over the world who are very interested in just being in this space of memory in the grounds that include Greenwood and Black Wall Street. It's important to note we're not the only entity trying to preserve the history. There are lots of small businesses that are in the Greenwood, Black Wall Street area that are trying to thrive. The Greenwood Cultural Center, which is where the president visits, has been trying to share this history for many, many years in terms of just presenting, having the history there that people can come in and see. It's a community and event center, but they have small exhibits that talk about what happened during the massacre, but also the people who helped build the area. It's also another entity called the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation, named for a great African-American historian whose roots are in the area. In fact, his father was one of the survivors of the massacre, but also reported on it as well. And so their mission has been to speak to peace talks and reconciliation and how the community can heal. And they have a beautiful park that is near the district. The district itself, I'd say, is very, very similar in scope to the 18th and Vine district in Kansas City in terms of cultural institutions as anchors. And then the goal is to have small businesses kind of build around that and for visitors to come. And so in so many ways, Greenwood area is a little bit ahead of Kansas City in terms of development, but in other ways, Kansas City has a lot more advantages. But I think both are models for what other communities can do with their cultural heritage.
So, Raymond, as the new director there, what are some of your goals for the Greenwood Rising Museum?
So, and I think even my friends at the baseball museum and many museums in Kansas City and in Tulsa and everywhere have the challenge actually of making sure local visitors continue to frequent the museum. And that's one of the charges that the board of directors has asked me to do, was try to make sure we increase our local participation. And I, when the museum here first opened again, it was open for free and they had thousands of people come through. So there may not be a big rush for local visitors. We are getting the steady stream of out-of-town visitors, and where we have local visitors, it's not a dearth of them. We are especially get a lot of repeat visits from the companies and different groups that have donated to the museum, especially through their diversity, equity, and inclusion program, and make sure that employees and family members get a chance to experience and understand that history. We've also been fortunate to have a relationship with the Tulsa Police Department, where they make sure that they bring, I think twice a year, they bring their recruits from the police academy through the museum. And that has also sparked other law enforcement, including we're expecting cadets from the academy in Wichita, Kansas, to come down in a few weeks as well. But beyond that, just like in any other museum, you come in, you've seen it, and so there's not a big rush to come back, and maybe if you have family members from out of town or something. So I sense a lot of community pride that the community's taking on these topics. But I have to still come up with interesting programming that brings visitors back to the museum. And the museum reflects on a couple of different themes. Entrepreneurship and business and the generation, the creation of generational wealth on one hand, and the end to violence and especially racial violence on the other hand. I mean, as we were coming into the show, you were hearing a reporting about what was happening over in Israel with the Palestinians and others. These things are related. I mean, you know, the Tulsa race massacre happened 100 years ago. There are similarities and themes that relate to our modern times that are reflective in what we learn in the history through the Red Summer, through Tulsa, and to what's even going on in the world today.
And as I stated at the top when we started out, that this is the worst incident of racial violence in United States history. There were, then in 1921, $1.5 million in damage, which they looked at in 2021 dollars, that would be $39.14 million, $750,000 worth of property damage, looting and things stolen from people's homes, which would be millions of dollars today. Mm-hmm. Raymond, and as I've talked to other people, and you've stated, a lot of people don't know that Tulsa race riot or race massacre, as it's called, it's not even taught in schools there. You know, what are you all doing to work to change that?
Well, it hadn't been taught in a robust way for many years. That has changed dramatically. But having said that, this unfortunately is a state, too, that for whatever political reasons has adopted some laws on the books statewide that, you know, are that are pushing back against critical race theory and different things. However, the state also realized that the importance of the story of the Tulsa event, as well as the general history of Native Americans, which is really the foundation and part of building the state, that cannot be ignored. And so there are carve-outs in that law specifically for those topics. So that's one. And it really is embraced statewide that this history should be taught and not whitewashed, if you will. And specifically within Tulsa, we have a program with the Tulsa Public School District. Every eighth grade student comes to the museum, and there's a tour group almost every day at the museum during the school year, from September through April. That there's usually a school group from Tulsa Public Schools, eighth grade, in the museum. In learning the history, they go, there's a curriculum developed by the teachers in partnership with the museum. So there's lessons at school, and then there's lessons when they, specific activities that they do on a tour when they come to the museum. And it's a very robust program. And so we won't have situations like we've had in the past where our young people and future leaders won't know this history. They're all getting it now. And it is talked about with the younger students as well. And then there's a ninth grade program too, and I want to take a minute to talk about this, because
Sure. This
pushes back against this very anti-intellectual, very insincere and craven political environment that we have, where people are kind of stoking up and gaslighting these issues of race and culture as some form of indoctrination, which the only indoctrination is coming from these people who are trying to suggest that their children need to be protected from alternate histories. And that's this, which is a ridiculous notion. These children are very resilient. This community is very resilient. And here's an example. I mean, that includes our nearby large city, Oklahoma City, as well, who has a very important civil rights history as well. But the ninth grade program includes a somewhat of a student exchange, where students from Tulsa go to Oklahoma City to visit the Oklahoma City bombing memorial, another act of domestic terrorism. And then a group of students from Oklahoma City come up to see Greenwood Rising. And then the two groups switch, and the Tulsa students come through Greenwood Rising, the Oklahoma City students get to go through the bombing memorial. And then afterwards, there's a talk back set up between the two groups via Zoom. And we had an experience this last Friday, with the groups. And It's a long day for the students, and they get an opportunity to talk and realize that it's hard to get young people to talk about anything, especially in a school setting. But we set up the talk back, and then the young people were asked to, you know, give some response and reflections on what they saw. And it was very quiet on both sides until one young lady stood up and bravely said, you know, I am agitated, I am upset, and I am annoyed by this experience. I just witnessed, through history, young people running for their lives, yet I get mad at my parents because they won't give me a cell phone.
And she said a mouthful.
She got it, you know. All these laws and some of these things are built under the guise of protecting our children, which is just false. These children are fine. They will get it. They need to be taught alternate. They need to understand that the history in America is complicated and it is controversial, and they should be allowed to learn that and question authority whenever possible. She should feel a certain way, especially after seeing both of those museums. And there's nothing wrong with that. And this is how we build good citizens and not people ignorant of the world. We're not going to send kids out of Tulsa now ignorant of the world and not be able to perform and be able to deal with other people in difficult situations.
According to the Oklahoma Department of Education, the Tulsa Race Riot was an option to teach starting in the year 2000 and was optional to teach in U.S. history classes since 2004, but it has been included in the Oklahoma school curriculum as of 2020, so right around the 100-year anniversary is when it became known. For myself, if it hadn't been for the movie done by John Singleton, who did Boys in the Hood, Rosewood, I would have never known about Tulsa, because I saw that and they made clues at the end about what happened in Rosewood, Florida, which was another one of the things with that had Don Cheadle and Esther Rolle, the mom who played the mother from Good Times. And that sparked me to think about that. And I then looked up and it was like Tulsa. I'm like, wow. And learned about all the different things there. Folks, this was the first time that there was bombing on the national soil of the United States. And it was the crop dusters who got planes and they threw incendiary devices throughout the Greenwood community, and they shot people from the air. Residents, from the eyewitness testimony that I was reading for this, said residents see the buildings burn from the top down.
But yeah, it was brutal. An unbelievable amount of venom and hate that just built up against this community that they were trying to control and couldn't really control. So they just basically lost themselves in trying to destroy this community. And yet they didn't fully because the folks came back and rebuilt. But like you said, Rosewood is 1923. Tulsa is 1921. Chicago is 1919 in the Red Summer. Houston is 1917. Atlanta, 1906. Nothing was learned from any of these previous situations, and we still have Rosewood happen, and Tulsa being, as you noted, the most violent and worst of those, and we still have Rosewood, and it's just amazing, just how virulent the racism was, and it went across regions, across the country.
So, get a little bit into the story here, but then we got to take a break. So, there was a catalyst event that started all this that happened in the Drexel building between a young man named Dick Rogan, who was a 19-year-old African-American, and a 17-year-old female named, I want to say it was Sally Page, and she was the elevator operator. Can you tell the listeners what happened to basically strike the match on the situation and started out to be a fast burn?
Well, it's important for us to also talk about really the conditions of Tulsa, white Tulsa, black Tulsa, and the Greenwood neighborhood before that, and hopefully we can do that more after the break. But those tensions were set off by the incident, really in the elevator, which really wasn't, that was only part of the spark. The situation was Roland was in the elevator with the young lady and something happened, but, and he may have bumped into her and she initially cried foul, saying that he tried to accost her. And he fled knowing that, you know, the situation could get kind of grim. But he was later arrested and put in jail, I guess technically for his protection. But it was the newspaper, as you mentioned earlier, a newspaper article about the situation that sparked the powder keg in the white community to want to come down and try to deal with Mr. Roland themselves. But they were met with resistance from African-American men in the community, many of them former World War I veterans who had weapons and were well-trained in using the weapons. And they were there to protect him at the jail. But the tussle ensued. Someone tried to take one of the black man's guns. The gun went off, and then it all broke out from there. But it is important, and we can talk about this, what set the stage in terms of what was happening in the structure of the communities that even led to this kind of blowing up.
We're going to take a short break. You listen to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today we have Mr. Raymond Doswell, who is director of the Greenwood Rising Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the site of the nation's worst race riot and massacre. Stay tuned right back after this short break. We're back. This is Joseph Jackson, hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM, KKFI. And our guest today is Mr. Raymond Doswell, who is the director of the Greenwood Rising Museum located in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, Mr. Doswell, are you with us, sir?
Yep.
Okay. So we were talking about, before we went to break, we talked about the event that was the occurrence that started everything. But as you said, what was the conditions of race relations there in Tulsa between black people who lived in Tulsa and white people who may have lived in Tulsa?
So it's important to understand the actual building and success of Greenwood neighborhood and the creation of Black Wall Street, as it was affectionately called. So going back to around, there are many during the migration, African-Americans that were being encouraged to move across the country out of the South, and there was a big movement trying to encourage them to come to what was called Indian Territory, which is now present-day Oklahoma. There's more history to that in terms of the creation of the territory and the relationship between blacks and the natives and things like that, but there were a number of black migrants who did come, including business people like O.W. Gurley. Mr. Gurley came and settled land well outside of Tulsa, in fact, another town. It's important to note that with this migration, there were several all-black towns in Oklahoma, over 50, that we had grew up in and around 1889 up to about 1901, 1902. And Mr. Gurley lived in one of those towns. He set up a farm, had a successful business, was doing pretty good. But something major happened in Tulsa around 1901, and that was discovery of oil. And oil made a lot of people rich. It's important to know, too, that there were natives and black freedmen who owned some of this land and got rich in terms of the oil as well. But near Tulsa, Perry moved his operations to near Tulsa, in an area where he could buy land. Oklahoma becomes a state in and around 1907. But the first law, official law on the books in Oklahoma that the new legislature passed, was about segregation, about where blacks could live and what land they could own. Gurley took advantage of that. And he bought huge plots of land, subdivided those plots, and began to sell those to migrants and other potential business people. And that became known as the Greenwood area, which he named it Greenwood. And the road that went down the middle, he called Greenwood Avenue. and that is partially named after Greenwood, Mississippi. He built a grocery store there. He supplied that store with his farm in the other part of Oklahoma, and it started to sprout out from there. Other people did the same thing. Other enterprising people bought land, subdivided it, businesses, hotels, stores, and all that began to service all the black people that were coming to town. The southern boundary of this neighborhood and area is south of the Frisco Line railroad tracks. That's the southern boundary. So we're literally on the other side of the tracks, black people. And then the south side of the tracks is the beginning of downtown Tulsa and the rest of white Tulsa as well. And then there's, of course, east, west, and north boundaries. So the area began to grow, and the businesses began to grow there. But it's the primary reasons why those businesses grew was the influx of black people coming. They could only live within a certain part of the city, which became that part of the city. And segregation, all spurred by segregation, and that segregation also kept them from really, for the most part, doing business with whites. Now, black people still depended on the white population because as oil boomed, everybody, black people and whites, were coming to Tulsa to work in the oil fields. And then the rich white Tulsans needed domestic labor, and they hired black people primarily for that. So there were those interchanges. But for the most part, black store owners didn't want to take white store owners didn't want to take black money. And so the black dollar stayed within Greenwood. And as a result of people owning land and having some oil rights as well, that money and those businesses in Greenwood began to flourish, to the point that one study suggested that $1 in Greenwood would pass through the community over 38 times before it went out of the community. And so people were becoming well off and wealthy for the times, based on the property they owned and the businesses they owned, and the community was self-sustaining in that way. But it was because of segregation, which was the main driver. But you had businesses, including a bus service, taxi services, even an airplane service that a black man, Simon Berry, owned, that would actually take the white oil barons across the state so they can check on their properties. You had women entrepreneurs as well. And it just began to flourish. But as the migration grew and people were growing, it's important to note this was not a utopia. There were still poor African Americans in this area, many people living in shacks and shanties as well. And the Greenwood neighborhood was beginning to kind of grow out and bust at the seams a little bit, to the resentment of whites. They didn't want black people going into other parts of the city, but they also were jealous of the wealth that they were creating. And the white Tulsans ultimately get pitted against black Tulsans, the poor white Tulsans who were not necessarily becoming rich from oil. It created these false tensions of superiority, and the black community, although having this business district, which Booker T. Washington called the Negro Wall Street, thus the Black Wall Street, even though having this business success, there were still these other tensions of the poor and the spread. And the black community was essentially, although successful in many ways, within a vice that they couldn't get out of, you know, if they wanted to explore and do more. And it was those pressures that ultimately triggered by the situation with the young people on the elevator, and then it all blew up.
And so it's, folks, if you want to know why it's so critical and why so many people got rich today in the African-American community, a dollar circulates 1.7 times. That means it barely circulates twice before it leaves that community forever. So when you look at not having grocery stores, gas stations, all these different places where we would go shop, and those dollars would stay within those communities, they pay salaries. But now, I mean, you have to go to a grocery store. It's not in your community, which means when that dollar leaves your community, it's permanently gone from your community. And so that's why it's critical for that. And so So now we have the foot incident. We have the armed African Americans down there who were just trying to make sure that this young man wasn't lynched, which was common practice in that time in that part of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. A man tries to illegally disarm a African American who owned his own weapon. Shots mm-hmm. were fired. The shots were fired, and as the report said, you know, the sheriff there said then that's when basically all hell broke loose. So what happened at that point?
Well, that's when white rioters began attacking blacks and the black community. And I think the shame of it was that the law enforcement of the day didn't really do anything to protect the black citizens. They didn't ultimately end up being complicit by deputizing many of the whites as rioters under the guise that they're supposed to keep the peace, but ultimately they were shooting and attacking indiscriminately. But there was black resistance as much as they could, but it was to no avail for the most part. What then ends up happening is at some point the National Guard gets called in. Well, let me first say the incident with the rifle happens around May 30th in the evening, and then everything goes all day on the 31st, and then by June 1, things have quieted down. The National Guard ends up getting called in, but they're rounding up black citizens, not arresting them, but putting them in an area of internment, ideally for their protection. But what it did, according to historian Hannibal Johnson, was that it left the neighborhood unprotected, the neighborhoods unprotected. And so then you have more looting and burning of houses after that. By the end of on June 1st, everything was quiet. And then it left the situation for African Americans trying to recover what they wanted to do. They couldn't get any redress from the city. They couldn't get any major redress from insurance companies. The county wasn't helpful. The sheriff's department really wasn't helpful. The state wasn't helpful at all. The newspapers and the mayor in particular tried to blame the riot on the black people. And the federal government response was very slow as well, although they did try to conduct some studies to see about why this happened and things like that. So the American Red Cross was one of the heroes in the situation because they were able to help with food, triage those who were hurt, and really in some ways come to the rescue. But even to the point that well, there's a lot of large Ku Klux Klan activity out here. That there's one story of some white Red Cross workers who live in Oklahoma City. They came up to help support the situation, but when they went back home to Oklahoma City, they're met with threats from the Klan for helping out. And so it's just a bad, bad environment. But black people are resilient. They set up tents. Lawyers and newspapers set up tents, restaurants set up tents to feed people. And even though they get thwarted by officials, they figure out ways to get money and people to send the word out. B.C. Franklin, John Hope Franklin's father, is among the people that are sending the word out to newspapers across the country of what happened. Donations start to come in, and they start to rebuild that neighborhood brick by brick. And they do so with businesses coming up and somewhat thriving, although still segregated, into the 50s and into the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, only to be kind of thwarted a little bit again, not a little bit, a lot of it, with urban renewal. Because one of the major things that happens is the neighborhood gets bifurcated by an interstate, Interstate 244 is built and splits right down the middle of the neighborhood, with clearly no regard for what the neighborhood needs were. But again, they rebuilt after that. And now people are realizing both the truth of the riot, which, and the language is important. Riot over the years had implied that the blacks were uprising and tried to start the situation. But massacre, which is language that has been now more formally adopted, puts the blame where it belongs, on the whites who perpetrated these crimes against people.
And one of the things, the 2001 Race Riot Commission concluded that between 100 and 300 people were killed, over 8,000 were left homeless, and over 6,000 minorities were put into detention camps. And, you know, the bad thing about that is that during World War II, we detained a lot of Japanese Americans and put them in detention camps, and they were given reparations and paid. But these people, over 6,000 black Americans were locked up, and not, for no reason, but giving no reparations, no nothing. The people, under the guise of the being law enforcement, looted their homes. And it took until 1996, when the riot's 75th anniversary, that the state legislature authorized the Oklahoma Commission to investigate the Tulsa race riot. So 75 years after it happened, the same thing that happened in Rosewood, you know, that they got theirs in 1998, 2 years later. And the commission delivered its final report February 2001, and it gave direct payments for reparations for survivors of the act, and there's still survivors alive. Direct payment for reparations to descendants of the survivors of Tulsa race riot. Scholarship fund was available to students affected by the race riot. Establishment of an economic development enterprise zone in a historic area of Greenwood District, and a memorial for the burial of remains of the victims of the Tulsa race riot. You know, it's so much that, you know, it's just so much to comprehend that we live in the greatest country in the world, and it still took over 75 years for people to get compensated for something that happened. But I want to go back to this, Raymond. This was 1921. 1919, we had Red Summer. Now we're starting to see these same type of events, you know, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, George Floyd, and others who've been murdered in the United States. Is what is occurring today just a different version of events that happened in the past?
Well, I think what's happening today kind of reflects the long-going tensions of what has happened in the past. The trigger incidents, if you will, of Mr. Martin and Ferguson and George Floyd really are kind of the outgrowth of events like Tulsa. And it's hard to generalize each event because of the different dynamics are in each community, in my opinion. But at the same time, I think the larger truth is the continued mistrust of law enforcement gets proven over and over again. Tulsa is one of those events, and is something that hangs over Tulsa law enforcement today. And I can tell you, having talked to them, they realize that and know that they have work to do to try to overcome that. And then, of course, there's the situation here. A young man named Mr. Crutcher, who also had to go, who was also summarily executed by Tulsa police. So there's a big movement around that. And that happened just a few years ago. Maybe not as well publicized as some of the other situations, but it was a very similar situation. So people are, it's different because in that the people of color are rising up against these unjust executions and voicing their displeasure through protest. I mean, the black people in Tulsa in 1921 were attacked. they're victims of a crime. But it all kind of, these situations kind of prove why people of color have this inherent distrust of law enforcement. And law enforcement, I think many departments and communities are having this reckoning with that. The folks, I think there's still great tension here with law enforcement in Tulsa. Just from my few weeks here, I noticed it. But I also noticed the efforts that law enforcement at least are trying to make to bridge those gaps. And the talk of police reform is a very important talk, and it should not be hijacked by the sentiment of people trying to demonize the defund the police kind of thing. It's a much more nuanced thing, and it can't be just cut down into slogans to kind of feel that people feel threatened about it. You know, the black community needs law enforcement even more than the white community, and no one wants to see their ability to help protect people be diminished. But obviously there needs to be a new thinking about that, because we have this history of this, of these systems of anti-blackness and oppression that have to be addressed. And you can't deal with the present without dealing with the past. And it's there.
I've got to ask this question because we're closing out pretty soon. Raymond, how far is the Greenwood Rising Museum from Kansas City?
It's only a four-hour drive down Interstate 49. Then you hit 44, and you come right on in. There is a toll booth, so have $5 ready. But otherwise, it's a fairly easy drive. I won't say it's the most exciting drive, but you can come on down. It's a very easy day trip. And Tulsa is a great town to visit. It's just a little bit – It's very similar to Kansas City, but the footprint's just a little bit smaller. Things are a lot closer to get to. They have a bigger – they don't have major league teams here, but they have big arenas. They do have minor league sports as well as great collegiate sports. Pretty good food. I haven't tried the barbecue yet, although I've been told I need to. But I think it's a wonderful experience. And, again, lots of other things for you to see. There's a great art museum here. If you're a music fan, if you're interested in people like even Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie, they have a museum building they share not far from the Greenwood Rising. And then, as I mentioned, the Greenwood Cultural Center is nearby, Reconciliation Park. There's minor league baseball that you can see. And lots of different activities are happening here. It's worth your time to spend a couple of days or a day or two not far to visit, and not expensive.
How long does it take to tour the museum?
We recommend at least 45 minutes. We do have tour guides if you want a guided experience, but I think you can also walk through on your own as well. As I said, it's a big building, but it has small gathering spaces, so we do insist on time tickets. Reservations are always preferred, but you can walk in, especially on the slower days during the week. But if you're coming on a Saturday, time tickets are strongly encouraged, and you might be able to come and look on your own or catch one of our docent educators and get additional experience of having them kind of tell you what's there. We have a holographic film exhibit with the barbershop where they talk about life in Greenwood, but we do have a very stark exhibit on systems of anti-blackness and the history of slavery going back to 1619 and just the sentiment that led up to the Tulsa Race Massacre, and audio of some of the victims of the race massacre in terms of survivors and their stories told in a very very immersive film exhibit. So it can be very emotional, and it can be in your face in some respects. But there are ways in which we even allow folks to bypass that if it becomes too much for them. But going through that, and then the more modern times in Tulsa, and then at the end, you are in a reconciliation space where you can dialogue and debrief about what you experienced. And then finally, you are asked to make a commitment to racial reconciliation. At the end, you can leave a message about what you're going to do to help heal our community.
What days is the museum open, and what is the cost to enter the museum?
So we do have unusual hours. We are open Tuesday through Sunday. Tuesday and Wednesday, we're open from 10 to 6. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we're open until 8 p.m. And Sunday, noon to 6. And then Monday goes back to 10 to 6. We're closed right now on Tuesdays. I will say, as a new director, I may change those hours by the summer, but that's what they are now. You can go to our website at greenwoodrising.org to make your ticket reservations and double check hours. Now, and occasionally we do have early closings for special events and things that we host. So you want to definitely check the schedule to make sure that you're able to get in the time that you prefer.
I want to thank Mr. Doswell for being our guest today. I tried to make it there last year, but I definitely plan to make it there within the next 12 months because I want to experience something that I only read about. So I want to thank you for being our guest today. We never end Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. The deadline to register to vote folks, for the April election is March the 8th, so that's next week. And if you're interested in being an election worker and working in the polls for the April election, give the Kansas City Election Board a call at 816-842-4820. Remember, the play only one day a year is at the Coterie until the 5th of March, which talks about how African Americans can only go to Fairland one day a year. And absentee voting is open at Union Station from 8 to 5 daily. So if you're going to be out of town or not available to vote, you can go down and absentee. On behalf of everyone, we want to say a happy 35th birthday to KKFI. This is the 35th year that the station's been in existence. So have a great day. Stay tuned for Signal to Noise.